You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, David.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
Doing well.
Good. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're David Yaden. You got a brand new book coming out. I think today, as we tape this, probably a few days before this actually posts, called The Varieties of Spiritual Experience, 21st Century Research and Perspectives. You're holding it up.
Holding it up. This is, yeah, it's book launch day. This is my very first book interview. So this is...
Oh my God. Well, that's a lot. That puts a lot of pressure on me.
It does. It really does.
I'll try.
And you actually read it.
Yes, I have. I have the PDF version. I don't have the physical version. So you are, and this is co-authored with Andrew Newberg, published by Oxford University Press. You are a professor at the Johns Hopkins Center for Psychedelic and Consciousness Research. Right. And by the end of this conversation, we will get into psychedelics, I think, although that's not primarily what the book is about. Johns Hopkins, it seems to me, is over the last 20 years has kind of become the place for research into psychedelics. It really was at the tip of the spear when psychedelics started to become kind of publicly respectable. Am I right about that?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, there's a number of sites that have been doing psychedelic research over the years. You know, Zurich, for example, Vollenweider, have been doing LSD research, but Roland Griffiths is the person who really kicked off clinical research and research on normal healthy controls at Johns Hopkins. I think he started around the year 2000. He mm-hmm. published a big 2006 paper, which changed my whole career trajectory, that paper.
Did it? In what way?
I remember presenting it while I was an undergrad, and someone in the audience, another student, raised their hand and said, "I can't believe this is legal, first of all." And I was specifically mentioning the finding, which continues to blow my mind. I think it's one of the most important findings in all of psychology in the past two decades, which is that 2/3 of the sample reported that the experience was one of the most meaningful experiences in their entire lives.
2/3 of people who had taken, what, LSD or mushrooms or
psilocybin.
Something?
Psilocybin. Just, mushrooms. Yeah, mushrooms. Although it's synthesized psilocybin, but basically you could think of it as magic mushrooms.
Uh-huh.
Huh. So that was really mind-blowing at the time. I think it should still be mind-blowing and is. But that just struck me as the real deal. I mean, this is a controlled laboratory setting where this kind of extraordinary experience could be occasioned or curated. Mm-hmm. And then since then, that finding's been replicated a number of times.
Huh. So let's talk about your book and get back to psychedelics eventually. The title very intentionally echoes the title of William James's, I think, 1902 or so book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. He, of course, is one of the most important figures in American intellectual history, psychologist, philosopher. As you note in the book, he's not nearly as well known as, say, Freud or Jung, although for my money, smarter. smart is a funny word, but I would say he had more actual enduring insights into human psychology and more balanced judgment in a way, right? He didn't just go off on his own little hobby horse and convince the world that it was genius stuff. I mean, he surveyed things broadly. And in this book, you know, he surveyed the whole realm of religious experience. He drew on the literature and looked at kinds of religious experiences people had reported, but he also, ahead of his time, he took, well, apparently, according to your book, he took mescaline and it had no effect, we think. But he also took nitrous oxide and it had profound effects. And he wrote about that in the book. But so talk about the relationship of your book to his book.
Yeah. So The Varieties of Religious Experience, absolute classic, extraordinarily important to me personally. Again, I had a spontaneous spiritual experience that was positively transformative, but also very confusing. And The Varieties of Religious Experience was the book that luckily I found because it convinced me that I wasn't going crazy and that these experiences are actually fairly common. And so...
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you and ask you to elaborate on your religious experience. I can't.
Well,
can't resist.
Yeah, but I do want to get back to James.
We absolutely will.
I just want to make
a point. We have a lot of time.
Okay, yeah, it was a... So there is that personal connection. So my experience occurred spontaneously. Happened, I've told the story a bunch of times, so I don't want it to sound like a rote repetition. But it happened spontaneously. I was lying in my dorm room bed, nothing special. There was no psychoactive substances involved. It was a time in my life I was trying to figure myself out. Things weren't clear about who I was, what I was doing with my life. And there was kind of this, the only thing I could describe is a kind of relaxation into the moment and this idea of, well, whatever will happen, will happen, you know, come what may. I don't know if I'm making that up, kind of narrativizing, but that was the context. But basically, at that point, a heat started in my chest, which felt initially like heartburn or indigestion. That heat spread eventually over my entire body. At some point, a voice in my mind said, "This is love." At which point, I became unaware of my body, went into my mind, went out of my body. It's difficult to parse those statements, but I saw 360 degrees, boundless horizon, and that feeling of love, which I felt it to be at that point, just increased to the boiling point. Probably only lasted a few minutes.
Love for everything in the world, love for just people.
The essence of the feeling itself, very physical. Distillation of that feeling. Mm. It probably would have been directed omnidirectionally, but that wasn't even part of it. It was sort of this more basic brute feeling. Mm.
Like this is the thing that can be applied to everything, kind of can be applied to other people.
Maybe so, but that would have come in the afterword of making sense of it. Mm. So I open my eyes, my body is laughing and crying at the same time, you know, things feel good, things feel new, extreme hope and optimism, but overwhelmingly the sense, what the fuck just happened to me? I mean, that question overrode all of that.
Do you know how long it lasted?
I don't know. Probably only a few minutes. Mm-hmm. It felt like hours or longer, you know, time sort of slipped away. Mm-hmm. But I had no reference points for this. You know, I didn't know. I thought it felt vaguely religious. It felt like it must be something religious just because that was the only somewhat close reference point I had at all.
Were you brought up religiously?
I was, yeah. Mm-hmm. A Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. It felt like it made sense. I wasn't religious at that point, though. Mm-hmm. But it made sense within that framework. You know, that was the closest thing on hand. But of course, that was never an experience like that. Wasn't spoken about in okay.
So I think a way to get back to James from there is for me to read a passage from his book that you quote in your book that is very famous. Mm. Here it is. Our normal waking consciousness, rational consciousness, as we call it, is but one special type of consciousness. Whilst all about it, parted from it by the flimsiest of screens, there lie potential forms of consciousness entirely different. We may go through life without suspecting their existence, but apply the requisite stimulus, and at a touch, they are there in all their completeness definite types of mentality which probably somewhere have their field of application and adaptation. No account of the universe in its totality can be final, which leaves these other forms of consciousness quite disregarded. How to regard them is the question. I mean, what a great writer too, you know? I mean, it's like that last line, how to regard them is the question. Anyway, so...
And that's the question of our book. I mean, in a nutshell.
Right.
That's the point of our entire
book.
What's
the answer? How do we regard them?
You have to read the book for that.
Okay.
I am really surprised you read the book. One time you said you'd never read anything when we when we had our... We had our regular talks for a while and you said, don't send me anything to read ever. This is the only time you've actually read something, which I really appreciate.
Well, I have a deep interest in the subject. Also, I do diligence for my podcasts. I try to.
Yeah.
I mean, we should say maybe we've known each other for a while. I think it must have been about 8 years ago I met you at this conference on the actual grounds of Canterbury Cathedral in England, and you were introduced as somebody who's working on this project to do some kind of version of Varieties of Religious Experience. I thought, well, good luck, but you actually got it done. Congratulations. So go ahead and talk some more about what the relationship this book has to James's book.
Right.
Are you picking up the torch, kind of? Or do you see yourselves doing what he would have done if he had lived and continued the thing, or what?
Well, in a way, yes. I think one thing we don't want to be presuming that we're doing here is providing a new version of William James's Varieties. Actually, quite the contrary. We're trying to get people to go back and read James's Varieties. Because that's, as you say, the writing is brilliant. You know, he's was considered then and is now one of the best writers of the English language, I think. I mean, I think this book is really in the canon. It's a classic. Mm-hmm. So we want people to go back and read William James's Varieties. I think that's number one. Number two is James was very insistent on these experiences being studied rigorously and interdisciplinary, from an interdisciplinary perspective. I mean, he called it the science of religions. And he said something to the effect of, if these lectures, which became the book, The Varieties, ever help become like a crumb-like contribution, I think he says, mm-hmm. to the science of religions, then he would feel that his life was well-lived. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be really important to him. So I think that's the part that we're picking up on, which is to say, look, James outlines this topic. He says we should study it. And we have, in fact, been studying it for a number of decades. And we're getting to the point now where I think we can move beyond these initial forays and exploratory studies on the topic into a robust, mature, interdisciplinary science and study of these mm-hmm. experiences. And that's mm-hmm. what's so exciting about, you know, the 21st century that we have ahead of us here.
And so you do a couple of things in the book. You survey kind of the main contours of the research that has been done since James. And then you've done surveys of your own, of people out there to get a sense for how common different kinds of spiritual experiences are. And I want to ask you about those. First, maybe we should talk a little about the relationship of the word spiritual to religious. I mean,
let me just talk about the survey, though, for one sure. second. You said I can interrupt you. So
I did say that before we started recording. I encourage people to interrupt me.
So I just want to give a caveat there. So we right in the beginning of this project, as we were thinking about and reading James, we thought, let's run a survey and see how these Freudian views and these Jamesian views hold up. And it was meant to be footnotes throughout the book. We'd say, hey, you know, here are some basic descriptive data bearing on this question. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to pay attention to the citations rather than the sort of toy survey data that we include. The figures make it look like we're promoting these particular data much more than we really are. They're just meant to show, look how easy it is to just gather some descriptive data to bear on these questions. So I just want a note of caution with overinterpreting.
Okay, well, your humility is admirable. I'm not sure it's what I recommend when you've got a book coming out, but I really respect the hell out of that, man. That is good context. But with that said, are there things, before we get into other research, are there things that you found that were interesting?
Well, I'll speak to the larger body of evidence from the field. I think the main thing that's interesting is that these massive polling companies like Gallup, the General Social Survey, and others have for decades run these big surveys asking people, have you ever had a spiritual or mystical experience? Mm-hmm. And they're phrased in different ways. Or another one is, have you ever had been close to a spiritual force that lifted you out of your sense of self? Have you ever had a religious or mystical experience that changed the direction of your life? You know, it's phrased in different ways at different times. But I think somewhat shockingly, about 35% of populations in the US and the UK endorse these statements completely. You know, on a scale of 1 to 5, where 1 is not at all and 5 is completely, they'll say 5 completely. I've absolutely had one of these experiences.
And it was significant, if not transformative, is what they're saying. It was
these experiences,
yeah,
that people are reporting. Well, it's unclear exactly, yeah, because it's just looking at prevalence. Usually I ask these questions, you know, I put these questions up and I say, what would you guess? It's hard to do now because you know the answer. But typically when I give talks, the guesses range from 5 to 95%. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are all over the board in terms of guessing how many people have had one of these experiences.
Mm-hmm.
I would have been one of the people saying closer to, you know, 5-10%. I thought they were pretty, mm-hmm, rare.
And what, again, I think I maybe laughed. So what is the wording? What does completely mean? If they say completely, what is the standard wording on these surveys?
Let's think of just one to sort of think in terms of.
I mean, you don't have to do it, cite it word for word, but.
Have you ever been close to a spiritual force that seemed to lift you out of yourself?
Okay. So that's an example where about a third of people would probably say completely. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's pretty significant. I mean, it's not just because I want to get into your kind of taxonomy of kinds of spiritual experiences. Right. And one of them is synchronicity. I don't think it's the most significant by any means, but that I would expect that, some version of that. In other words, for people to go, whoa, that's a weird coincidence. I wonder if that means anything. I think most people at one time or another have done that, but that's right, different from the thing you just described, right? And of course, this speaks to the challenge of defining spiritual experience and so on. But you take my point that there are gradations and qualitative differences.
There's definitely gradations. And James made the point that there are these gradations, but he's interested in the more extreme phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Pulling from his background in naturalism and physiology, you know, if you want to understand an organ, look at unusual circumstances or extreme conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's doing that there, and we do that as well. We say, look, there's clearly this spectrum of intensity. You know, some people, you know, they say, oh, well, you know, I was looking for a parking spot and all of a sudden one appeared. So yes, I've had a spiritual experience, you know, or I find comfort in my belief in God, for example. Those are things that are interesting and important to study, but they're not our topic.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at stuff, intensely altered states of consciousness that involve some seeming perception of an unseen order and that are rather transient in time. So that's our focus, and it was James's as well, because you have to mark out your topic somewhere. So it's not to say that these more subtle experiences aren't important. It's just that our interest is in these more extreme examples, and the Gallup type surveys don't differentiate on that spectrum.
Right.
So realistically, if you're talking about really intense experiences, it's probably some minority of that 35%.
Now you use the phrase unseen order. James described, I forget if he was defining religious experience or religion or whatever, but he said something to the effect, religion lies in the idea. He was trying to come up with a way of describing religion sufficiently broad to encompass all the things that are called religion, I guess. And he said it's the belief that there is an unseen order and that our supreme interests lie in harmoniously adjusting ourselves to that order, which I think is like a genius attempt, at least, to encompass a lot of stuff. But I would also say that that's a definition of religion that almost excludes some things we would call spiritual. I don't know, but are you, anyway, my question is, are you, at the same time, James describes some things, some experiences that we might not necessarily call religion because they're kind of abstract and they are more spiritual, but are you using spiritual as more or less a synonym for a modern day synonym for religion or what?
In some ways. So right off the bat, we say, okay, why do we call it the varieties of spiritual experience? And it's because a bunch of scholars over the years have said, if James was alive today, he would have undoubtedly called his book The Varieties of Spiritual Experience, mm-hmm. because he was thinking in this broad way as well. Mm-hmm. And we actually polled people and said, describe these experiences. And we said, what do you call this? And spiritual was the most popular label. But in terms of, how do you define religion and spirituality? We have a whole chapter on this. It's difficult.
Yeah, you don't have to do it now.
But. No, we don't have to do it now. But religious or spiritual belief, I think a supernatural type belief could be roughly described as belief in a non-physical mind of some kind. Hmm. I think that covers most cases. Hmm. It's not perfect. I don't think there is a perfect here. Certainly others could do better, but that's a sort of rough-hewn distinction that I think is worthwhile.
Okay.
So if you think of a religious or spiritual belief that doesn't involve a non-physical mind of some kind?
Well, I mean, let's actually get to one of your particular I mean, I don't know if you'd call it your finding, but it's your observation that you say surprised you. And I think this gets at a lot of issues, this one thing, that there are experiences that are described as unitive. You know, I was at one with the universe, I was at one with God, whatever. And then there are experiences that are described as ego dissolution. Right, the dissolution of the self, the bounds of self or something. And I think your expectation was that those are in some sense fundamentally the same. I mean, this gets a lot of issues, actually. But there's something you were surprised by, right, about the relationship of those two. So describe, and I mean, first of all, by way of a footnote, I would say I'm not sure having that experience demands you rethink your conception of mind, but maybe it does. Anyway, let's leave that aside. And why don't you tell us what you were surprised by?
Yes. So yeah, the unseen order. Before we skip totally by that, I mean, we draw on your work actually in the evolution of God, where you talk about the unseen order and how that can consist of a lot of different things, mm-hmm. Including things like entropy, for example. And
that's not my favorite candidate, but it's possible. Okay. Yeah.
Well, you were thinking more teleological type processes or something, maybe.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, we don't need to get into my thing. We have time at the
well,
end. Maybe
we'll draw on your book there, because I think it was important, the evolution of God and the unseen order aspect. And so then, because it leads directly into this question of our typology that we created, which is, you know, people who said, yeah, I've had one of these spiritual type experiences, we asked them a ton of questions, all, you know, made like 100 or so questions about the experience, what it involved. And then we did factor analysis to find these clusters. And, you know, we find that some experiences are about God. Some of them are about ghosts or other entities, and some of them are about unity. Those are like the three broad clusters. And of course, mm-hmm. we have a nine-factor taxonomy, which gets even more specific. So there's this question, well, okay, is unity an unseen order, perceiving mm-hmm. unity?
Mm-hmm.
We think yes. And in terms of its interpretation, it could be supernaturally interpreted or not.
Mm-hmm.
So some people have this unity experience, you know, they're blended with everything and they're aware. So therefore, awareness must be everywhere. You know, maybe an eliminativist would have that experience and say mind is nowhere. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But other
okay,
people.
Okay, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Or that it was a delusion of some kind. But in that unity type, that did split into a relational component and an annihilational component. Actually, my wife coined those terms. I have to give her a bit of shout out for that. But the relational is just connectedness, and the annihilational is ego loss.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought those were two sides of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out they're differentiable from one another, even though they're highly correlated with one another, and they predict slightly different outcomes. Basically, feelings of connectedness is generally felt to be positive mm-hmm. in valence, just feels good. And ego loss can feel good or cannot feel good, can be scary, could even be maybe related to dissociative type mm-hmm. states or conditions. So it's less related to positive outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of surprising to me. There's a lot of times people emphasize this self-loss, ego loss aspect, but I don't think that that's, if you care about positive outcomes, at least, that's the primary component. I think the connectedness aspect or the relational mm-hmm. aspect probably matters more.
I kind of share your intuition that they're almost two sides of the same coin. I mean, I've had the experience of like a meditation retreat where the boundaries of the self start to seem to dissolve. And it is a sense of connection where, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is my ego had not come close to completely dissolving even during this experience. Maybe that's why I saw it as fundamentally, in some ways, an experience of unity with the outside world, even as I felt the bounds of the self dissolving. But one of the interesting... Okay. What's that?
I mean, I'm just curious. I mean, curious to hear about your experience and whether it felt like it was a positive or...
Oh, it was positive. And the feeling, the exact kind of observation I had at the time was like, okay, there's a tingling in my foot. I can hear a bird sing. The tingling in my foot doesn't really feel like more or less a part of me than the bird singing.
Hmm.
Okay, so this actually gets an interesting philosophical thing involving Hinduism and Buddhism, which is that, Buddhist meditative practice derives from an ancient Indian context. And there's, you know, if you can get Hindus and Buddhists arguing about who deserves the most credit if you want. But Hindus are more likely to describe an experience of oneness, I would say, a merging of Atman and Brahman, self and the kind of universal soul or something. With Buddhists, of course, there's the doctrine of not self and of emptiness, which is a description of, well, I don't want to get too deeply into this. The point is, I have always thought that if you talk to a Buddhist who's had this deep meditative experience and they're calling it not self and emptiness, and you talk to a Hindu who's calling it oneness, I would have predicted that if you look at like a brain scan, it's the same thing going on in the brains. Now we don't actually know yet what the answer to that question is, do we?
No, I don't think so. I think there is a distinction that's important, though, between theologically correct and what experiences look like or are felt as and described as amongst most people.
Right.
You know, unless you're talking to a serious Buddhist scholar, like Bhikkhu Bodhi, who we both know, mm-hmm. you know, he would talk about anatman and you know, the extinguishing of the flame and in that very annihilational, in our terms, way. Do most monks in that tradition who have these experiences during meditation, do they have it in exactly that way? Yeah, I'm not so sure. Especially when you're not talking about monks, you're talking about just normal people. Mm-hmm. You know, these experiences start to look very untheologically correct, which of course is its own interesting historical topic that we could go into about mm-hmm. heretics having these experiences and authorities trying to corral them into the certain interpretations, etc. Mm-hmm. But to the question of Buddhist and Hindu interpretations, it's very interesting, and we can never fully take beliefs out of the picture and cultural context. As much as we might try, as psychologists and neuroscientists at least, these things are inevitably part of our measurement process.
Yeah. This points to, there's another thing you talk about in the book that this is directly relevant to, which is the debate between so-called perennialists and constructivists. So perennialists think that the seeming differences across cultures in terms of experience are pretty superficial. There's something fundamentally the same going on when you have a Christian saying they felt union with God and you have a Buddhist saying the kind of thing I just described. And then there are the constructivists hold it that actually, no, the experiences are deeply different across cultures, right? And would you say James was searching for a kind of perennialist? That's perennialist in spirit, right? His book?
I would say he inspired a lot of perennialists who were way more extreme than he was.
Uh-huh.
And so he's often blamed for this very naive, simplistic perennialism. But if you actually read James, he constantly contradicts himself and provides alternate perspectives. Does the same thing with emotions. He talks about sometimes this idea that there seem to be these universal emotions, and other times that every emotion is as unique as a stone in a New England farm, or, you know, mm-hmm. provides some analogy like that. And I think he does a similar thing with these kinds of experiences. If you can pull out quotes that make him look like a complete perennialist, but then you mm-hmm. can look at other places and he says, no two experience is alike, you know, and he's looking at experiences across traditions for a reason. And so, you know, I think this is a reason why in contemporary studies, we need scientists and scholars. Because oftentimes with scientists, at least psychologists and neuroscientists, they're going to be more perennialists mm-hmm. because they'll say, well, we all have the same nervous system. And the instruments, sometimes the measurement instruments, self-report scales, sometimes lend themselves to a narrow kind of experience that's being tapped. Whereas mostly scholars in the humanities, you know, their methods are reading texts. And so what they're saying is, look, actually read these accounts. You know, they're talking about very different things. You know, one person talking about Jesus and God and the Holy Spirit, and this person's talking about Vishnu and Krishna, entirely different
mm-hmm.
You know, cultural setting, beliefs, etc. So I think having a naive perennialist view is no longer tenable. Mm-hmm. And I try to get scientists all the time to read these works by scholars. It's kind of a tough sell. So the book is in part this attempt to say, look, philosophy matters, scholarship matters, that it has to be part of the discussion. But it's also aimed at scholars. You know, I've encountered scholars who thought that no data could bear on any of these issues in interesting ways. And so I had some of these kinds of people in mind as I was writing this.
Okay. So you know, one thing you naturally are inclined to do if you're a scholar and you're trying to tackle the whole realm of spiritual experience is come up with some categories, you know, in the spirit, maybe, of what we just said in a certain sense. But you know, they're not all the same. And not all these things we're calling spiritual are not the same. And so you do some of that. I'm going to list the titles of what, like 5 or 6 consecutive chapters, and then ask you to say a little something about each of these. Okay. So, one is numinous experiences. One is revelatory experiences. One is synchronicity experiences. One is mystical experiences, unity and ego dissolution. We alluded to that. Aesthetic experiences, awe and the sublime, and paranormal experiences, which includes like ghosts and angels and so on. So start with numinous. There after the colon, I think there's something about, yeah, encountering divinity. So talk about that a little.
And then I'll preface it with doing the thing you said not to do, which is undermine.
Humility? No humility. No. Okay, go ahead.
Well, we say the taxonomy fails in the second to last chapter, but the numinous experience. So this is presence of divinity. So this notion of all pervading mind, what Huxley called mind at large. So mm-hmm. this. Sense in that there's mind that's somehow infused into the material existence or somehow beyond it, but relating to it in an important way. So this is probably, this is an experience of God. This is probably what James talked about most in the varieties, but this feeling of diffuse presence of non-physical mind.
Okay. So, I mean, most people have the experience would describe it in more specific and concrete terms, as we've just suggested. They'd have a cultural context, they'd apply to it. So this can include... go ahead.
There's the emic-etic distinction. You know, it's...
Talk about that a little.
And anthropologists talk about the emic perspective, which is, you know, from within the group. And so a Christian would say that was Christ. You know, or, you know, different traditions would say they'd use the terms that they're used to using.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the etic is kind of the more academic outsider perspective. And that's more vague terminology, like the terminology I use, like this diffuse non-physical mind. Right. Okay. God experience, basically.
Okay. And I wonder, I'm trying to think, you know, I how broad this category of experience is. Like when I was, you know, I was raised Baptist, and when I was about 8 or 9, I made, you know, they have at the end of each service they have an invitation. They usually sing one of a couple of hymns, like "Just As I Am" or "Jesus Is Tenderly Calling" or something. And there's an explicit appeal. If you watch a Billy Graham thing, this is the culmination. He's calling people to come up to the altar. That means they're surrendering their lives to Christ and they are going to be baptized. And in the Baptist tradition, you know, you don't do that like at birth, like in Catholics. It's important that people make the decision to be baptized. And my parents weren't there. And I later heard that they were a little troubled that I had made the decision this early. But I responded to the call. And I remember... it was the middle of a so-called revival, and so they're kind of, they've been priming you for this. But anyway, it's hard to describe, but there was definitely a feeling inside of me like this is the right thing to do. It was an external, I was just wondering, this is going nowhere, except I was wondering, would that qualify as a sense of, I wasn't that strong as, I mean, there must have been a sense of divine presence that was doing the calling. But I don't know, is that something you haven't heard much about in all of your that specific experience? It's an interesting one.
It's an interesting one. Yeah, I'm curious.
It felt like kind of possession. It was like there was something out there moving me. This is the right thing to do. It felt like that.
Well, that part is the most interesting part, I would say. The something moving you. How how was that message received? Or were you perceiving something inwardly?
I mean, it was definitely an inward. I can still feel it in my chest.
Huh.
I mean, I think I remember what it felt like.
Wow. Yeah, and it was certainly an other.
But it was coming from the outside. I mean, and this is not to get too wrapped up in me, but this is another question I have for you. It's like, I sometimes describe like the nature of my conscience to people who weren't raised religiously and they can't relate to it. And it's this. It's, you know, because I'm no longer conventionally religious. I'm no longer have, you know, Christian beliefs or confident theistic beliefs. But the form that my own conscience takes is still a sense of being judged from the outside. Does that seem crazy?
No. No,
okay.
I don't think
so. Good. Ooh, that's a relief.
but the experience you describe in particular, you know, Tanya Lerman's work would probably speak to it quite well, which is this idea of being prepped, being primed in all kinds of different ways. And then when you have any emotional excitement or ambiguous outside or inner stimuli, you're much more likely to attribute it to the thing that you've been primed to experience. That model, I think, works not as well to explain spontaneous experiences that don't have this obvious priming process.
Like but yours.
Right, exactly. But the one you just described, if it's after this whole revival where you've been primed and set up for this kind of feeling, and then in this emotional excitement, you know, it's this kind of ambiguous sensations and arousal, maybe those expectations will pierce through into your actual sensorium and your actual perception, and you just have the experience.
So back to the numinous, I mean, the kind of, are there particularly mystical versions of that? I mean, you hear about people like, is it St. John of the Cross? You hear a number of figures in Christian history who had these intense, well, probably Joan of Arc, I guess, but had these intense experiences of kind of, I don't know, visitation or what. But I guess you had to think about, well, how broad a range of experiences qualifies as numinous.
Well, the data did that a bit. But yeah, I mean, in this case, it was this diffuse sense of mind. But these categories are not mutually exclusive. So you can have a deep feeling of unity and a deep feeling of divine presence or this non-physical mind in all things. So that would just be an instance of both of these categories at once. And those certainly occur.
Now, maybe I should have actually saved Joan of Arc for your next chapter, now that I'm looking at So revelatory experiences, : voices, visions, and epiphanies. You know, there's obviously going to be some possible overlap here among categories. But
oh, there's much, much overlap.
Right.
But yeah, so that three, those three of, yeah, call it just for the sake of being able to remember, God-type experiences, ghost-type, and unity-type. And then there's subcategories. So we're all in these subcategories of God-type experiences, really. But yeah, revelatory experiences are these moments where you receive information from beyond the sense of self in an inward way. And so, yeah, voices, visions, epiphanies that feel like they are delivered to your mind whole cloth, and don't come from your normal process of cognition. So hearing voices.
What's that?
So hearing voices, you know, it's a classic example.
And here, you know, the question of mental illness enters the picture, right? Was, you know, are you schizophrenic or are you not? I guess it's a question if you're hearing voices and. And of course, there are people, there are certainly academics who would say the answer is yes. I mean, hearing voices, they're not there. And that's it. On the other hand, there's such a fine line between experiencing a thought and hearing a voice. You know what I mean? It's like,
right.
But anyway, go ahead. Well, or did I just label myself as crazy? Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, no. Well, really, though, it's not just this category. Every category, the issue of psychopathology is important to consider in each and every category, because and positive outcomes and prevalence, you know, in each of these categories. And it gets back to your thought on Freud and Jung and James, where Freud, you know, when he heard about these experiences, he would have looked at them and said, these are all species of psychopathology, mm-hmm. you know, never having had one of these experiences and just thinking they're weird and not collecting any data whatsoever. Jung mm-hmm. was sort of the other extreme, a bit more nuanced, but tended to see these types of experiences as wholly positive, and speaking to a kind of, you know, collective conscious. And James was much, much more nuanced. He really did bend over backwards to acknowledge that not all these experiences are positive, as do we in the book, and that some of them are indeed related to psychopathology. And I think you're right, revelatory experience is a good category to drill down on this. Because, yeah, if someone starts hearing voices, they should seek out a mental health professional. I mean, that's the advice. Mm-hmm. However, a lot of people end up hearing a voice here and there throughout their lives. It's actually quite normative. And many people, some of them are just random voices, you know, but some of them, you know, you hear something quite meaningful and it ends up being a positive experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, on a meditation retreat, I've had a different kind of experience than the one I described where it's more psychedelic and really results from a different kind of meditation in a certain sense than the first one, but where I kind of heard a voice, and I would think it was actually one part of my brain talking to another part, or just one part of my brain expressing itself, and I was hearing it as a voice. I guess if I did that 24/7, it might be time to call 911. But
was it a meaningful message, or was it just sort of neutral gibberish?
There were two different ones. Neither was gibberish. One I described in my book on Buddhism, Why Buddhism Is True. And it was actually, I don't want to, never mind. This is your book. So it was interesting.
Well,
but
I'm super curious, but.
Well, okay. We can talk afterwards. We've got plenty of ground to cover. So the next one is, and then of course the third thing in that sequence under revelatory, voices, visions, and epiphanies. I mean, your thing, that your experience was kind of, was that an epiphany where you felt the power of love?
I wouldn't say so. Information wasn't conveyed. Uh-huh. Directly in like a representational form.
It wasn't, now I get it, colon. and there's something after the colon.
Right, right. Exactly. And there's this interpretive component. Like you said, oh, this is my brain, different parts of my brain talking to one another. Some people choose that interpretation. Some people think that was God that spoke to me. Interestingly, there's often an assumption, if this was my brain speaking to me, that must be a symptom of mental illness. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's God, then that's a good thing. I think it's very important to break that necessary connection. Even if it's part of your brain talking to another part of your brain, the outcome of that experience can be quite positive and meaningful, and therefore it doesn't make sense to think of it as a sign or symptom of mental illness in any way.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to look to the outcome. And so if the outcome is good, it's inappropriate to think of it in this pathologizing way, which many people still do.
Right. And I mean, you know, the point of James's quote that I read earlier is, don't be so judgmental. You know, James was writing after Darwin, and I guess he recognized that, you know, the brains we have are products of natural selection, a particular evolutionary path. They're designed to take care of an organism. There's no reason to assume that the form of consciousness that leads to on a day-to-day basis is the most valid or truest way of apprehending the universe. And you know, I might say that with respect to your experience, that, you know, not that you said yours was a feeling of boundless love, I guess, but it was a feeling of love. And I would say, you know, a feeling of boundless love is probably, you know, pure, true, utterly boundless. There's probably no way for an animal to go about getting its genes in the next generation. I mean, unless, you know what I mean? I mean, the point is, I think that was kind of the importance of James's insight. In fact, he uses the term adaptive or something, I think, in that phrase, that they may have their realms of being adaptive and these different states. So anyway.
And he makes a big deal about the kinds of things that we can't answer, the kinds of questions we can't answer, and takes those issues off the table largely till the very end, and says, let's look at what we can actually study scientifically, causes, correlates, and consequences, basically. But yeah, in terms of, you know, whether it's true or not in the supernatural sense, basically says we can't know that scientifically, at least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So synchronicity experiences. Now, I have asked a couple of times, asked classes of students, have any of you ever had the experience of, like, maybe you're under pressure to make a decision? Should you break up or not? Should you take this class or not? There's just, you know, for some reason, a little tension. A song comes on the radio or something, right as you're thinking about this. Or in some other room, there's some kind of coincidence, and it really gets your attention. You're like, whoa, is this guidance? Is this? And an extremely high percentage, in my experience, of people have had those experiences. Large majority. Now, does that qualify as a synchronicity experience, or does it need to be more enduring conviction following from it, or what?
I think we specify that it should be an intensely altered state. So okay. Again, we're trying to look at these more extreme instances. So it shouldn't be a kind of a casual, like, oh, I was just thinking of that word and now I'm seeing it on a billboard. You know, it would be more of these sort of momentous life moments. You know, I'm trying to decide whether to be a physician or a scientist, and all of a sudden, you know, five tractor trailer trucks go by in a row that all have, like, physicians on the side of them advertising them, and
all of them say, you know, become a doctor on the side.
Right. Right, but then there's a response that is in intensely altered in some way, in which, you know, that the meaning feels like it's directly for you and extremely salient, and it feels like a message from somewhere.
And what would you make of the fact that drugs can enhance this predictably, right? I mean, I would think marijuana, psychedelics, all have the tendency to make you more likely to see coincidences as meaningful, right?
Right. And some mental disorders as well. Yeah. And, you know, there are states. So we were thinking of the trigger being the coincidence, but there are states of mind in which things that don't even seem like a coincidence
right.
will be felt to be a coincidence. So it goes that way.
Well, in a way, I mean, that's... Oh, you mean when you say felt to be a coincidence, you mean felt to be meaningful or felt to be not meaningful? Felt to be meaningful.
Yeah, sorry, meant to be very meaningful.
Things that most people would not say are unlikely. Seem like right. unlikely coincidences. Well, I see. That's what I think.
Or even not a coincidence that other people may not see it as a coincidence. I mean, you could say, you know, if you're in one of these states in which everything is being felt, you know, your signal to noise detector is fully on everything's signal,
right?
And you look at your desk, and there's a letter there, and it's from Ohio, and you feel strongly that is saying something
right.
important, but everyone else in the room would say, what do you mean? That's not even a coincidence.
And what they're thinking partly is that's not even that unlikely, right?
That too.
Well, that's what I mean is that drugs, I think, you know, marijuana and psychedelics can change your threshold for thinking of something as a really unlikely and therefore probably meaningful, but really unlikely, right? Like you'd have a straight person in the room, totally stoned person in the room, stoned person is going, what are the chances? And the straight person is going, oh, about 1 in 2, you know, what are you talking about? So that's just an interesting fact that you can change the brain chemistry and change that threshold. And of course, the path you're describing, like more and more things seem meaningful. At one end of that is a certain kind of mental illness, right? Where suddenly the dog is talking to you, right?
What's interesting, even here, I don't think that a psychopathological framing is the foundation. I mean, this is a cognitive shift in your signal to noise detection of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But it can go in slightly positive directions. Like there's paranoia, the belief everyone's out to get you. There's also pronoia, the belief that everything is conspiring in your benefit. If you have a little bit of that, it may not end up causing suffering in yourself or others or cause dysfunction. And so you really can't call it a mental illness. You can point to epistemic problems with the inferences the person's making, but in terms of calling it a mental illness, I don't think it would warrant that label.
Mm-hmm. So then you've got the chapter Mystical Experiences, Unity and Ego Dissolution. We talked about that, but what else do you want to say?
That's probably the most studied in terms of scientifically. A lot of the psychedelic research is going in that direction. I think these experiences occur during mindfulness as well, lower intensity. It's just supernatural attributions can occur or not in all of these, but I think it's easiest to talk in terms of unity type experiences in a non-supernatural way. And so I think that's probably why they've been taken up more so.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the word mystical is applied to a lot of things. This is one way of defining a mystical experience. I remember that in James's book, he describes a mystical experience as noetic but ineffable. That is imparting knowledge, but you can't articulate the knowledge. You're sure, you know, but I could be wrong.
No, that's right. And it's paradoxical. A feeling of knowing or knowledge being conveyed and yet not being able to articulate verbally anything about the experience. And so at other places, James talks about the noetic quality as this feeling of reality, like you're mm-hmm. tapping into the real reality. And the everyday reality is somehow not as real.
Right.
So that's a different way of thinking of noetic quality. But yeah, in these more mystical type unity experiences, there's not necessarily any kind of revelation that occurs. It's just this deep feeling of connection.
But there does tend to be a feeling at that moment that this is true, right? Like,
right.
And maybe realer than your ordinary, truer than your ordinary way of looking at the world.
I think that's right. Yeah. And which was why I think it technically still counts under that unseen reality aspect. There's
you mean the unseen order or the
unseen order? Yeah. It feels like you're tapping into some kind of deeper aspect of reality.
And again, I mean, one would imagine that natural selection would tend to take consciousness, whatever consciousness is, and shape it into this very self-centered thing, this ego. And that's a byproduct of an evolutionary process. It's not necessarily the truest view of the universe, right? So could make sense that you have one of these experiences and think of it as true. So aesthetic experiences, awe and the sublime.
So it's psychologists talk in terms of awe. It's the positive-ish, but also can be negative emotion. It's a complex emotion. Dacher Keltner and Jonathan Haidt really kicked off this whole sub area of studying awe. But what psychologists call awe, philosophers call the Sublime. There's a lot of work on the Sublime. And we kind of criticized James for not bringing in any of that work. He would have been, of course, aware of philosophical work on the Sublime. He doesn't really bring it in to his discussion. Mm. Maybe mostly because he's trying to do psychology more so than a review of philosophy. We don't bring all that much scholarship or philosophy in either. Kant, Hegel, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche all talked about the Sublime and having this ego transcending component and this feeling of being in the presence of something grand and kind of a sacredness or importance and feeling of possibility. I mean, they're very interesting subjective qualities that are listed there.
Yeah. And I think I would imagine that, first of all, some people are more aesthetically sensitive than others. I'm not so aesthetically sensitive. My wife is. But some people are more inclined than others to almost interpret those as religious. I remember I was talking to a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary at that time, and we just ran into each other every once in a while. And he was describing an experience he had at the opera, and I don't know if he started crying or what, but for him, this was clearly, it was like a religious experience.
Yeah.
And not everyone would describe a profound aesthetic experience that way. Maybe that's an example of having a cultural framework for interpreting this feeling. But
yeah, I mean, you mentioned a lot of people have synchronicity experiences. I think this category is the one that everyone can kind of empathize their way into, exert some cognitive empathy and understand what people are feeling, but also just emotional empathy. I mean, basically what I'm trying to say is most people have had an intense experience of awe at something, you know, sweeping scenery, you know, that could be good, you know, art, music, or ideas. I mean, you know, sometimes you truly understand an idea that seems to explain a lot, and you're left in this this feeling of deep awe.
Right.
And
absolutely. Now that I have. I mean, I have aesthetic experiences too. I don't want to.
Right.
But intellectual unity, like an idea that unites previously diverse phenomena or something, that can be a profound experience.
Right. And maybe there you're seeing into this deeper aspect of reality, or it feels as if you are.
Now, paranormal experiences, ghosts, angels.
So this is something, I mean, it's a benefit of running a little survey. I don't want to make too much of that again, but I didn't.
We know.
Well, it's an important point, I think, but we didn't imagine so many people would talk about ghosts. I mean, that was a real surprise. When I think of spiritual, mystical type experiences, what really I had in mind was these unity experiences and maybe these numinous God experiences. But a lot of people talked about ghost experiences. We kind of class like sort of psychic and paranormal stuff in general in this broad category. I think the most interesting part of this is seeing an apparition of a recently departed loved one, which is shockingly common. My wife's a psychiatrist. She even had this on a test in medical school. Was someone describes a recently bereaved man describes seeing a ghost of his recently departed wife. You know, do you refer to inpatient psychiatry, outpatient psychiatry, or just say that that's normal? And basically, the gist of it is no, that's normal. It's actually, by some estimates, it seems really high, but around 50% of recently bereaved spouses will see a visage, an image of their recently deceased spouse, which I find very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
how common that is. And these experiences should be part of all of this this research as well, because I think they're fascinating.
Yeah.
You ever have a ghost story? Or someone you know and trust who has...
I don't have a ghost story.
Even William James felt weird about the ghost stuff. You know, he provides a few examples and he says, you know, to the audience, like, this may seem strange to you, but I'm going to tell you another story. And this is from someone I really trust. You know, he's to really be aware that this is a strange...
Didn't he fool around with seances or something? Or am I...
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So his wife, Alice, and brother, Henry, were both really interested in spiritualist phenomena. Mm-hmm. So was James, really, sincerely so. He called it a search for his white crow. So he said, you know, disprove a universal proposition. You don't need to find boundless evidence to support it. You just need to find one counterexample. So to disprove all crows are black, just find mm-hmm. one white crow. Mm-hmm. So he thought if he could find one instance of psychic or paranormal phenomena that could be replicable, that would be of important, you know, right. historic importance. It's just that every instance he looked into, he kind of ended up in this debunker role of charlatans or sort of wishful thinking.
Yeah. So we said we'd talk about psychedelics and I guess, well, maybe drugs generally, because, you know, James experimented with nitrous oxide, as we said. And know right. what? He got a unitive thing out of that. Is that?
That's how I read it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seemed all of the opposites of reality were melted into a unity. He said it was the strongest emotion of his life. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we can take that quote, you know, if we take it seriously, it's a big deal. He said he could only understand Hegel in that state, which is interesting. Well, actually, he and his friends used to rent out a theater and they would take turns taking nitrous oxide and give monologues to the rest of the group.
That made no sense to the rest of the group, right? Or is that right?
I think so. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it just is sort of paradoxical statements.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about psychedelics, which I guess nitrous oxide is not classified as psychedelic, is it? It's fundamentally a closer to being, well, it's almost sui generis. It doesn't sound that much like an opiate, although it's used for anesthetic purposes.
Right.
But it's different.
It's different. Yeah, usually when we the word psychedelic now generally is being used to refer to serotonergic psychedelics, psilocybin, LSD, DMT.
But even there, you get fundamental differences. I mean, on the one hand, I've heard people describe, you know, well, I think you get into this. We've talked about the difference between unitive and... Well, let me just ask it. Just talk about the difference between, on the one hand, DMT, and on the other hand, things like LSD and mushrooms. Because I've heard people who have taken DMT, and I guess ayahuasca is in that category, right? Because is DMT derived from ayahuasca or in ayahuasca or?
In ayahuasca.
Okay. So you, from people who have taken DMT and ayahuasca, you hear these stories of visitation. A being right. came and talked to me.
Yeah.
You don't get that very much from mushrooms and psychedelics.
That's right.
So why don't you do a little compare and contrast here? What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, Roland Griffiths has a paper on this comparing psilocybin, LSD, DMT, and ayahuasca in terms of these entity encounters and other characteristics. And just like you say, with DMT and ayahuasca, you get more of these entity type encounters, which mm-hmm. in our taxonomy, we would class more under a paranormal type experience. Although most people attribute a lot of beneficence and kindness and kind of sacredness to these entities.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a it's a fuzzy, all of them are fuzzy categories, but this one especially so. Whereas, right, psilocybin and LSD, you get a bit more of the mystical type category of these feelings of unity and mm-hmm. connectedness. But it's an important part of the research on psychedelics that we're broadening out and capturing more of these interesting experiences. We're not just looking at mystical type experiences, we're capturing all kinds of inner experiences.
Yeah. Now, the drugs that have been used effectively to help reconcile themselves to help people reconcile themselves to impending death, like cancer patients and so on. And I think some of this work has been done at Johns Hopkins, right? Those tend to be conventional psychedelics, LSD, psilocybin, right?
Just psilocybin. Yeah, we focus mostly on psilocybin. Uh-huh. And that's most of the research that's been done. Very similar. Maybe LSD has a slightly more dopaminergic quality, although a lot of the research is showing that subjectively they're very similar.
Mm-hmm.
But LSD lasts substantially longer. So psilocybin has the virtue of lasting about 5 or 6 hours. And so it's easier on people, participants, to come in, you know, have the experience and then still have time to go mm-hmm. home, process.
And these are guided experiences. They may involve music, various other things, but it's not like these effects, are guaranteed if you just take the drug.
It doesn't help everyone. Mm-hmm. Some people have negative experiences that are difficult, challenging, and end up benefiting. Some people have difficult negative experiences and they don't benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have, persisting negative effects, although in the clinical setting so far, that's been a pretty tiny minority. But it's important, I think, you know, there's so much hype about psychedelics. I think it's important to emphasize that there are real risks and it doesn't benefit everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But the end of life terminal diagnosis application, I think, is very compelling. Because there aren't many tools available there in our mm-hmm. society. You know, there's antidepressants, there's opioids, you know, there's other tools that are there. And it's good to make available those tools for those who can benefit. But, you know, this existential aspect of confronting the reality of the situation and being able to connect with loved ones in a sincere and open way. It looks like, as of now, from these trials, psychedelics could really play a role there, which is something new. It would be something new in mm-hmm. our society in the way that we face end of life.
What are some of the other kinds of benefits people get from psychedelics?
This deep feeling of meaning feels very important. I think it's really interesting to kind of characterize exactly what people mean by that. Some of my new work is in that direction. The other benefits are maybe more straightforward: boosts in mood, better attitudes about oneself and the world, altruistic impulses, and, you know, overall well-being,
mm-hmm.
you know, life satisfaction, things like that. And then it appears it could be potentially effective in various disorders like mood and substance use disorders. Mm-hmm. So depression, anxiety.
Yeah, I know people who say psilocybin has helped with anxiety. And there is not infrequently a unitive or ego dissolving effect. Am I right? I think in Michael Pollan's book, his big ego dissolution experience is on psilocybin, right? He wrote this book, best-selling book, How to Change Your Mind, which
right.
was which helped, is a milestone in the legitimation, I guess, of psychedelics. That this was a mainstream book that was a big bestseller. But I think psilocybin for him was ego death, unless I think that's the one where he says his ego became a bunch of post-it notes or something? Maybe I'm getting the stories mixed up.
I don't remember which story goes which. I don't remember exactly. Yeah, I mean, that book was really important to counter these decades of drug war propaganda and the scaremongering, you know, especially among, I think, older people who all know Michael Pollan's work really well and trust him. But he also is just very, very clear, a good writer, and look at, and in terms of the way he looks at the history and describes it in this fair way.
Mm-hmm.
He might not have emphasized the risks of psychedelics and the fact that they don't work, you know, for everyone. Everyone doesn't have this amazing positive transformation, which the Netflix documentary on his book, it conveys that sense. I mean, those are some quibbles, but overall, I think he helped provide a new social narrative for psychedelics that wasn't this, you know, drugs are bad and psychedelics are the worst drugs of all, which is kind of what you got in, you know, DARE classes and things like that.
Yeah. And I think he has his disclaimer line, his to be sure line about, you know, these things can work out badly, but you're right. It's overall I mean, he has some negative experiences, I think. Now, I think there's one a drug he took that's interesting because it seems so kind of anomalous. It's the version, I think it's a version of DMT that...
Yeah, 5-MeO.
Yeah, 5-MeO. So it's the one that in organic, when it's organic, it comes from a toad or something, right?
Right.
But can be synthesized. And that is said to, when it works, I guess, as a lot of people hope, to lead to ego death or lead to ego dissolution. And I gather not so much to the kind of thing that other versions of DMT lead to, which is like visitation by some seeming being that has an important message for you.
It's a fascinating distinction. And that's been... collected anecdotes about these two substances make that clear. I don't know that there's been a systematic investigation yet. Would love to do that. I know Imperial College London is looking at 5-MeO DMT. I would really like to run a study at Hopkins. Because it's short acting. So there's 5-MeO DMT and call it NN-DMT. Yeah. One of them associated with these entity encounters, one with this sort of unitive consciousness. And actually they're structurally quite similar in terms of their molecules, and they both last, you know, 20 minutes or so. So they're much more manageable. There's so much research that needs to be done in the field of psychedelics on the clinical side, but also just the purely scientific, psychological side as well.
Right. And, you know, it all, for my money, brings back that quote from James, like, you know, putting a substance in your brain can take you further away from reality for sure, and in a very pathological and dysfunctional way. But there's no reason to believe that, given the fact that our brains weren't really constructed fundamentally to perceive reality wholly and truly, and in fact, in some ways, designed by natural selection to give us perceptual and cognitive biases and to, in a certain sense, mislead us. No reason to believe that in some cases you're not getting closer to what could be called a true view of the world.
He was very open about those possibilities. I mean, he ended up having this pragmatic assessment, you know, and he's of course known as one of the co-founders of philosophy of pragmatism. Yeah, and his view was, look, if a given experience results in benefits to yourself and others, and if it fits with your other beliefs and knowledge, and if you look at it in the long run, then you have some ability to not only say that experience was useful, but also that it could be true, which is a controversial sort of direction to take. Of course, you know, Bertrand Russell and his crew thought that was ridiculous, but. That's his pragmatic assessment. And by the way, you know, he was close colleagues with Adolf Meyer, who was the founder of psychiatry in the U.S., who was at Johns Hopkins. And, you know, so James's assessment of these of experiences, this pragmatic view, found its way into the foundation of contemporary psychiatry, which is, that's a story that hasn't really been told.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Johns Hopkins, so you're at the medical school, right? That's where all this work is being done? Johns Hopkins
Medical School. Yeah. Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences, the department.
Okay.
So it's in a larger unit too, the Behavioral Pharmacology Research Unit, which is well known for studying all kinds of drugs in a fairly ecologically valid way. And so that's kind of the history of it. You know, all opioids, amphetamines, alcohol, cannabis, mm-hmm. and then psychedelics are, you know, our center is now situated in this broader unit. So we're looking at all kinds of substances.
Okay. Is there much cannabis research? It's weird. That's the most widely used of all of these, but you don't hear that much about the science of it.
Oh, there's, yeah, you should have someone on from the cannabis group.
Yeah, at Johns Hopkins?
Sure, yeah.
Ah, sign me up.
Yeah, yeah. I can't really speak to it, to be honest, where the field is currently. I know they're testing a lot of, you know, myths or mm-hmm. or ideas that are out there. You know, how detrimental is it? Does it, you know, can it actually trigger psychosis at some doses? Are there entourage effects with other active components?
You mean aside from THC?
Can there be benefits? Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And can there be benefits? So there's a whole science of cannabis that's worth looking into. Don't see a huge amount of cannabis triggering spiritual experience, but there's some of that. Psychedelics are in a totally different category, though, in terms of a trigger. Psychedelics are pretty reliably having the effects of people saying, yeah, that was a spiritual experience.
But I would think cannabis for a lot of people deepens aesthetic experience, which is on your scale, right?
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
So anything else you want to say about the book? It's been a great conversation.
I appreciate it. Great questions. Let's see. There's the reveal at the end of James's professional and personal conclusions, which I think is interesting.
And do you want to go ahead and do the plot spoiler, or
should I spoil it? I
mean, it's totally your call. You and your marketing consultants.
Well, my marketing consultant is just me wanting to have people take a grain of salt with any of the data and, you know, the typology. Another spoiler alert is we say the typology ends up not working and we need to do better in the field going mm-hmm. forward. But yeah, I'll spoil it. The professional conclusion is that James says he doubles down on this methodological agnosticism that he carries on throughout the book. He says, we're setting these philosophical and theological questions aside, and actually we're always going to have to do that as scientists. These are largely unfalsifiable claims, and none of the evidence from any of these experiences, of which he's listed hundreds, counts as evidence for any supernatural reality or lack thereof. So that's the professional conclusion. But then, which I think is a really surprising moment that a lot of people miss in the varieties itself, James's varieties, is he then offers his personal conclusion, which is he says, I'm going to take the leap of faith. And apparently, that's James's phrase. It's not Kierkegaard. That's what mm-hmm. Rebecca Goldstein argues, at least. So he says, you know, there's such a thing as an overbelief, and that's when you don't have good evidence, one way or another, that you can form a belief on the basis of its benefits, essentially.
Yeah.
That his belief in other realms of consciousness, of non-physical mind, makes him more sane and happy and true. And so therefore, for him, that's enough.
Mm-hmm.
I find that highly admirable, that the fact that he doubles down on the methodological agnosticism, yet also says what he himself has chosen to do.
Yeah. Yeah, he wrote either a long essay or short book called I Think the Will to Believe, which he's kind of, he's making an argument that it's ultimately in the spirit of his philosophy of pragmatism. Right. And I forget what he's trying to talk himself into believing, whether it's a theistic belief or belief in free will. He did both of those at times, I think. But anyway, that's a fascinating little intellectual exercise. I don't recall it quite persuading me, but but he's such a great writer and thinker.
Exactly, and he does that twice in his life. He chooses to believe in free will as an adolescent. Uh-huh. Really, or a young adult who's depressed, and says, my first act of free will be to believe in free will, and he felt like that helped him.
Yeah.
And then later in his life, he does the same thing, this voluntarism, and says, well, I choose to believe on the basis of the benefits.
Yeah. Well, free will is a better argument than theism in the sense that belief in the doctrine has an effect on your behavior, and the doctrine is about your behavior. Doctrine is about human behavior. And believing in free will is, you could argue, is an act that, you know, it's a doctrine that becomes true if you believe in it, because then you behave like a person who has free, I don't know. But anyway, he would have applied the pragmatism to both, I think, theism and theistic belief and belief in free will.
I think so. Right. I like his professional conclusion. I mean, I think staying in that space of unknowing is a kind of continuing source of awe and wonder. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, this was great. Thank you so much for reading.
Well, congratulations. It's a very ambitious project. You did it. And now it's out. And I think you've done a great job of presenting it. And so enjoy the process and maybe we'll check in down the road.
Thanks so much. Yeah, talk to you soon.
Okay.